Hey there, and welcome to another edition of the In Layman's Terms podcast. I'm Steve Layman, sports anchor at News Channel 5 and the play-by-play voice of Belmont men's basketball. So glad to have you here with us today, and I think you're going to enjoy this one because one of my predecessors is on the podcast today. Kevin Ingram, a voice that so many of you know, probably all of you know, actually, has been behind the mic for some of the best moments in Belmont basketball history, from the initial days of the move and the transition into Division I to that epic overtime win over rival Lipscomb for the first ASUN championship back in 2006, of course, to the end of the Rick Byrd era in 2019, win number 800, the heartbreaking loss to Ja Morant and Murray State in the OVC championship, the euphoria of getting into the NCAA tournament with an at-large bid, and then the first ever program win in the Big Dance over Temple, and the stories that follow, including him getting smashed courtside down in Jacksonville ahead of the first round of the NCAA tournament game against Maryland. So many great stories from his broadcasting days, from off the court, his relationship with Coach Byrd and Casey Alexander as well, and what he's doing now down the road at Vanderbilt as the voice of the Commodores men's basketball team and also a voice of SEC Network broadcast of just about everything Vanderbilt. I hope you sit back and enjoy as we catch up with Kevin Ingram, former voice of the Belmont Bruins and now the voice of Vanderbilt basketball. All right, well, I would like to welcome into the program a great friend of Belmont University and of mine as well, Kevin Ingram. You know him as a longtime voice of the Bruins, now the voice of the Vanderbilt Commodores as well, just up the road. Kevin, how are you?
Doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great to catch up with you again. And how are things going down the road there at Vanderbilt? First off, were you there on Saturday night? I know you were, but where were you during the 100-minute rain delay and that exciting game against Hawaii?
Yeah, I was actually up in the booth for pretty much the whole thing. Actually, we have an office in Memorial Gym, so I went over there for a little bit of it and kind of waited it out. I had some food and just sort of hung out for a little bit and just sort of waited for some sort of word on what the game time was going to be. And once we established that, we had already done an hour of our pregame show, but once they told us the game time, we were able to figure out the time to restart and what we were going to do. And when the game started, it was pouring down rain pretty good. So I was on the sideline of my rain gear. One thing I learned from doing sidelines for a lot of years, you don't leave home without your rain jacket. And it came in handy again on Saturday.
Take me back to December of 2020. You were right in the middle of the start of another Belmont basketball season, and this opportunity comes on the table. What was that moment like for you, and how difficult of a decision was it at the time to abruptly switch gears and move across the street?
Yeah, it really was an interesting time, Steve. And, you know, we'd all been through the COVID year, and, you know, if you think back earlier in the year, it was heartbreaking that Belmont lost his chance to go to the NCAA tournament after winning the OVC. And we had started the season and part of it was we were doing games from home or from the office or whatever, because it was that strange COVID season, 2020-21. My time at the Zone had come to an end, in August of that year. And I was really looking for a more full-time opportunity. And then kind of the unfortunate circumstances with Joe Fisher, leaving Vanderbilt, I'd worked with him for a number of years in the football broadcast and in other roles. And then the opportunity was presented to me to come and fill the rest of the way for the basketball season and then potentially do baseball after that. And I just, at that point, again, I needed to have a full-time job. And I felt like the Vanderbilt opportunity eventually would afford me that. But it was really sad and hard to leave Belmont too. I'd been there for so many years, really 17 seasons, full-time calling the games. I did a TV show with Coach Byrd for another year. And then I'd started what would have been my 18th season. So, it was certainly difficult to step away from Belmont, but also exciting at the same time to have a chance for an increased role at Vanderbilt, where I'd I'd worked in various roles around Vanderbilt for a long time, since 2002, whether it was on the football broadcast or when the SEC network came along in 2014, I'd worked in all those different capacities at Vanderbilt. So it was exciting, and it was hard too at the same time, after all the fun years I had at Belmont. But I just was kind of certainly looking for a full-time position at some point, but also looking for, you know, a chance to challenge myself and try something new. And, you know, gosh, I've loved my time here at Vanderbilt. It's been wonderful. It's been great to be a part of this university, and also to call games in the SEC is really, really special for somebody who grew up in SEC country. So it's all worked out great.
The institutions are pretty different, but they truly are neighbors in the heart of Nashville here. And so many people have relationships with both schools. There is kind of a synergy there. Heck, even the basketball teams get together in the middle of the summer and play when the coaches aren't around. So there definitely is kind of a relationship there. Did that make it easier in terms of making the move?
Yeah, I think it did, because I always felt like there were those connections too. We can all name a whole bunch of them. I mean, you think about, the year I did radio for Vanderbilt's baseball team, Luke Murphy was one of the star pitchers, and his cousin Grayson Murphy was a terrific player at Belmont. So, I mean, I got to know their family, and I'd seen Grayson and his family at the games doing basketball, and, you know, got to know some of the rest of them and those connections. And Tim Thompson, who I do basketball games with at Vanderbilt, his daughter Lauren actually played at Belmont. And their friends are the McCabes. Scott McCabe played basketball at Belmont, and their daughter Sally was one of the great players. Their daughter Sally was one of the great players at Belmont. Scott played at Vanderbilt back, I think, late 70s, early 80s. So, yeah, all kinds of connections like that over the years. And I feel like there's a very kind of, if there's a rivalry, it's sort of a friendly rivalry, more like neighbors as much as anything. But those connections certainly, made it a smooth transition, and certainly didn't have to drive very much farther because they're right next door to one another.
And I don't think there's any place, maybe anywhere, that has as many cranes and construction projects going on than Belmont right now. But if any place could rival it, it's Vanderbilt Athletics with what's going on with Vandy United. How exciting is it to see it up close and personal, what's happening with First Bank Stadium and the basketball complex and everything over there?
Yeah, Steve, it's really exciting. It's just outside where I'm recording this interview. I actually had to move a couple doors down because there was a big piece of construction equipment that was making a lot of noise. And, you know, the beeper that comes on when it backs up, it's like, do you guys ever go in forward? And they've been doing blasting this morning too. If things start shaking, don't worry. They're just blasting outside. But it's really neat to see what's going on here. The Vandy United program started back in 2021, and it was just an initiative to raise a lot of money. The initial goal was $300 million to really do wholesale improvements on the athletic facilities. And to see not only the money get raised, but the actual work begin, I think has been really rewarding. Candace Lee, our athletics director, is just a tremendous leader and has been at the forefront in this. And a lot of support, too, I think, that has made everybody around athletics feel like it's even more important with Dr. Dearmeyer and some of the others here on campus that have been very supportive of all these things. You come over to a football game. If you're here on Saturday night, it was very noticeable because, and it wasn't like, to me, I've been around it a lot. Like, I've been on campus so much that I didn't really think a whole lot about it, but North End Zone and South End Zone, there are construction projects going on in both at First Bank Stadium. They're building a new basketball facility on the north side of the stadium that's going to double as game day facilities on the side that faces the field. And then in the South End Zone, and that's going to be done hopefully next year. It is going to be beautiful. It's going to be an awesome facility when it's all done. And then a couple years down the road, there's going to be a new facility in the South End Zone, which will be all sorts of game day experiences and all sorts of spaces. And it's all part of a wholesale project here that's going to really change how all of this looks and feels. And it's going to be a lot better for fans and for the student athletes. So it's really exciting. It's cool to be a part of. There are definitely some growing pains with the construction that's going on, and you have to walk around a little more, but I can use the exercise. And I thought, you know, the way the fences were put up behind the end zones the other night, I was making the joke to Clark Lee when the game was over. It's like, I felt like we were in a fenced in backyard, you know, playing this football game. And I kind of liked it. I thought it was cool. It kind of gave the stadium a whole different vibe.
It was intimate for sure. I felt like I needed a hard hat walking around a couple of times, getting around the stadium the other night. But
yeah, the folks doing running the cameras were actually up above where the fence was, and I think where they were actually required to wear hard hats and the fluorescent vest, because I looked at them and I thought they were kind of just doing it for show at first. Like, that might be like an OSHA thing or something where they have to actually wear the gear.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So there's so much construction there. Obviously, you have seen up close and personal the growth of Belmont over the last two decades. You mentioned 17 seasons as the voice of the Belmont Bruins up until 2020. Take me back to the beginning, though. When you first had conversations, I think about my moment. It was similar to yours going to Vanderbilt, I guess, and that it was on the eve of the season, and they said, hey, we need somebody right now. Can you come join us and do this? And there wasn't much time to think about it, but I had the background. If I had covered Belmont for more than a decade, I knew Coach Bird, I knew Casey really well, and certainly knew the program from the outside looking in. So it's a pretty easy decision. At that point in time, Belmont, at least as a Division I program, was new. It wasn't totally clear what the future would hold. What were you thinking at that moment? How did your initial relationship with Belmont begin?
I had covered some of their games and gotten to know Coach Bird a little bit. I'd been to some games over the old Stripling Gym, which was the longtime former home of Belmont basketball before the Curb Center was built. And it all worked out well. Steve Selby had been the announcer for Belmont before me, and he was going to leave to take a job in Memphis calling the games for the Memphis Redbirds, where he was for a long time before, I think, retiring just a couple of years ago. And he told me about it. It's like, hey, I'm going to be leaving. If this is something that might interest you, you might check into it. And so I always loved announcing basketball. I'm from Kentucky. So, I mean, that probably tells you all you need to know about my love for the game. And I was looking for an opportunity like that. And I was, at the time, I was doing sports for WTN and WSM. I was like the morning sports anchor on those two stations. And so I looked into it and had a conversation with Coach Bird and with Mike Strickland, who was the athletic director then. And they brought me on board. And it was a really interesting time back then, because when I started doing the games in the 2002-03 season, Belmont didn't really have a home. Stripling Gym had been torn down, and they were using that space to build the Kirby Event Center. And so we played home games in three different places. We played at Aquinas, we played at Municipal Auditorium, and we played some games at what is now Bridgestone Arena. So we were all over the place playing those games. And every now and then I might text Casey or Coach Bird or something if something big happens for the program. And I was like, this feels like a long way from playing our games at Aquinas, which was a very intimate gym just down the road here. But yeah, it was fun. I was so appreciative of that opportunity and that they brought me on board way back then. And the program's come a long way in that 20-year stretch.
When you think back on that journey, are there a couple moments or a specific time that stands out to you that's really sped up that ascension?
Yeah, I think they won an East Division championship in the Atlantic Sun the first year I did the games in 2003. But what really – and they went from there. 2003-04 had a really good season. But when you fast forward to the 2005-06 season, that's where it felt like things really started to get rolling for the program. And the moment for the program at that point was the Atlantic Sun Championship game in Johnson City against Lipscomb. And it just felt like it was destined to be those two teams playing for the title in the old mini dome over there at East Tennessee State. And it was an epic game, and Justin Harris' heroics are legendary, and it went to overtime and Belmont ended up winning. And that really jump-started the program. Went on to play UCLA in the NCAA tournament, another Bruin team that was just stocked with future NBA stars. And we played them out in San Diego. But from there, three straight Atlantic Sun championships and trips to the NCAA tournament. And it just felt like it was off to the races after that. But that game against Lipscomb in Johnson City was the moment at that point. And it was an epic game that could have gone either way. And I've thought about that a lot, of like what Lipscomb's fortunes might have been had that game gone in the other direction, because neither one of the teams at that point had been to the NCAA tournament before. And it was a long time before Lipscomb got that chance again, but it was such a joyful moment and everything for, for Belmont and for Coach Bird and the staff and those players at that time. That's something that I don't think anybody that was around will forget anytime soon.
My first real exposure to Belmont, Kevin, was actually that 2006 team in San Diego. I was covering Illinois while I was in college at the time, who is in that pod, different part of the bracket, but in that pod in San Diego. And so here's this Belmont team getting set to play UCLA, and you see them up close and personal, and you learn about the many celebrities and music stars that have gone to the school and all those sort of things. So it's interesting that you point to that game, because that was sort of the moment that was like, oh, this Belmont school can play basketball at the highest level as well. Certainly put them on the map. When you think back to those first few years, though, that wasn't the first good team at Belmont. How much do you reflect on the guys that built the program, really, and helped make that transition to the NCAA, who maybe didn't have the opportunity to play on CBS against UCLA, but are certainly a part of what Coach Bird and now Casey have built?
Yeah, they didn't get a chance to step out there against Jordan Farmer and Aaron Aflalo and Luke Richard.
Which may or may not be a good thing.
A quick story about that. Brian Collins hit a three early in that game, and Belmont was in front. I always wish I would have taken a picture of the scoreboard at that point. But, yeah, you go back to those NAIA years, and, you know, it was a difficult transition going from NAIA to Division I for the program. And there were certainly some tough moments along the journey, and that's what made finally having that reward and getting to the big dance and all that so special for everyone. But yeah, you think about some of the great NAIA teams that Belmont had back in those years, guys like Joe Bailing and gosh, Scott Speedy and Casey Alexander and all those players back during that time. I'm sure they thought a lot about how cool it would have been to be on that stage. But, you know, they had a lot of success at the NAIA level too. And they went to, you know, the national championships and things out in Kansas City a lot of times. So success at a different kind of level, but there are a lot of great players even before the ones that we know more familiar over this last stretch of years.
You said you were familiar and knew Coach Bird a little bit when you took the job as the play-by-play announcer. But when you really got to work closely with the program and closely with him, what were your initial impressions, and then how did they evolve over the years?
Yeah, Coach Bird is just one of a kind. He might be my favorite person I've met in sports. He's just such a great coach, but such a great man too. But as a coach, what always stood out was just offensively, just how it felt like the wheels were always turning and that system just worked so great. You know, they were in that 4-out-1-in motion for all those years. And the thing about Coach Bird is, though, you know, he's kind of an old school guy with those, you know, hardcore principles and discipline and those things, but he's also very forward thinking, as a basketball coach. He wasn't afraid to try new stuff or use technology to his advantage, and you know, certainly took full advantage of the three-point line. Just an amazing basketball coach, really, and it was fun to see him. You know, even as the teams evolved over the years, you know, he would stay right up with the times and whatever was going on. He was always on the cutting edge of playing basketball and coaching basketball, and I will say that over the years too, like I became. I hope he would say the same about me, but he just became somebody who's just really, really special to me. Fast forward a few years to 2013, my dad passed away in the middle of the season. And I felt that team like really embrace me. And I told Coach Bird that when he retired in 2019, I kind of held off on having any kind of conversation like that with him. But you look for those voices and those roles, you know, when you lose those people that are really important in your life. And he became even more of one of those for me as the years went by. And I really have treasured my friendship and working relationship with Coach Bird, and always brings a smile to my face anytime I talk to him, or I still text with him here and there or see him at a game. He's really one of a kind.
He's one of the most well-rounded people I feel like I've ever met, in that he's so competitive. It's obvious how he won so many games. He's so detailed. He's so bright and smart when it comes to it. But he's the same on the tennis court. He's the same on the golf links. I'm sure he's the same playing checkers or Uno at home. But at the same time, he's the kindest, you know, sweetest man you'll find out there. And he's just fun. He's got a great sense of humor. As you mentioned, he maybe doesn't strike you as this with the sweater vest and some of the old school principles, but he lets his guys play. I think he jokes around a lot. He's just a really interesting, fun, great guy who is one of the best who's ever done it at what he does. And I actually appreciate this. It's one of the few things that I really enjoy about Twitter, Kevin, is that you see these kind of basketball-specific accounts now that will find great plays or great sets, you know, whether they're kind of a teaching account or just something that points out something that happened in a game. And it's so interesting to me how often you'll see a Belmont play or that either Belmont itself ran or that somebody else now is mimicking. And I think that's great because I don't know if the nation as a whole, Belmont people I think did, and certainly people in basketball understood it, but I don't know if the world totally understood how great of a genius Coach Bird was when it came to plays and baseline out of bounds and late game situations and all that. And I think even now in retirement, they're getting a better taste of that.
Yeah. In retirement, I always wonder, like, when he watches games, is he still coaching it in his mind? It was always really interesting to me if we were on a road trip somewhere and, you know, say the night before a game, we're either out having dinner or just hanging out at the hotel or whatever, to sit and watch a basketball game with Coach Bird, because it felt like he was watching a completely different game than what I was watching. It was like you could see the wheels were turning and he was making notes, and even made the joke one time. He's like, you know, if you want to scout us, then, you know, maybe watch some other games during the week, because I'm probably going to take something from one of those games and try to do it with our guys. But yeah, it was the level of knowledge and thought that went into what Belmont ran with Coach Bird was just off the charts. It was really fun to sit and watch a game with him, and you could just really see the wheels turning and the thought process going on there for him.
Well, that says so much about him too, because so many coaches just do their thing.
Yeah,
we run this set, we run this many motions, we're going to do it regardless of what you do or how we're performing. And the fact that he's willing to evolve even on the fly like that, I think says a lot about him and the type of success he had. On those staffs from the very beginning, Kevin, was Casey Alexander, a guy that you have already mentioned was a great NAIA player there, was an assistant for a long time. You saw him in those early days. Now you've seen him back. You worked with him for a short time as he came back as the head coach. Are you at all surprised at the success Casey has had as a head coach after working with him for so long?
Nah, not in the least. It felt like in a lot of ways he probably could have been a head coach sooner than he was, but he waited for the right opportunity to come along. And on that staff, when I very first started doing the games, those three assistant coaches were together for a long time. Of course, Brian Ayers, who's still on the staff now with Casey, and Roger Edstrom, who's an assistant coach at Lipscomb, and is also a great friend of mine and has been for a lot of years. You could definitely see that Casey was going to be a head coach and be a successful head coach. But yeah, he just waited for the right opportunity to come along. He went to Stetson for a couple seasons and then came back to Lipscomb. I think his family really wanted to be back in Nashville, and that was a good opportunity that worked out for him. And I know everybody's thrilled that he's at Belmont. He's done a terrific job there. And I was proud to get to do that first season with him as a head coach. And even though we didn't get to actually go to the NCAA tournament, we did make it and qualified with that tournament win. But yeah, he's just he's a terrific basketball mind in his own right. And, he has innovative ideas and really knows how to relate to the players, and will do a terrific job for a long time in that role.
Yeah, a lot of the foundation that Coach Bird built into the program and built into that coaching staff, Casey's got. But he also has some of his own ideas as well, and they've worked out very well. He's known a bit as a practical jokester, I would say. You traveled with him for many years. Did he ever get you, or do you ever have a good story about Casey in that regard?
I don't think he ever really messed with me. If he did, I don't remember. He very well could have. But some of the stories are legendary. His thing is to like hide somewhere and then jump out and scare people. And one of the funniest ones I ever heard about, and I don't remember who it was, but we're on a road trip somewhere, and he went in somebody's room, and this was when he was an assistant coach. This has probably been 15, 20 years ago, but you know, like at the top of a bed, you have like the pillows and the way the quilt or comforter or whatever goes over the top of them. Well, he took the pillows away and he hid like long ways across the top of the bed, if I remember the story right. And then put the cover over top of himself. And then when the person came in, he like jumped out and got him. And the one of the other funny stories related to Casey being a bit of a prankster was one time in it was kind of the early years of the Kirby Vince Center. Roger Eastrom, who I mentioned a minute ago, who was assistant coach, working at Belmont at the time. Casey, one of his favorite targets, I always got the feeling, was Roger, that he liked to jump out and get him and all that stuff. So Roger was going to get him back one day. He was in the hallway down the curb center, you know, those long hallways that go behind like where the locker rooms are and stuff. And he heard somebody, Roger said, I heard somebody coming. I was like, it's Casey. I'm going to get him. I'm going to get him back right here. So he hid behind the corner. And when the person came around, Roger jumped out and yelled, but it wasn't Casey. It was Mike Curb. The namesake for the Kirby Vince Center. And Roger said he was so embarrassed and he apologized profusely. But
great.
but yes, Casey is legendary for those things. And I don't think anybody's really off limits, including his wife, Sunny. I've seen some videos of him like hiding somewhere, even on an airplane or at home or something like that. And he is notorious for that.
And mine is always working. Well, you watched the growth of the program, and now you've watched the last few seasons with Casey and all the success. He's as winning as coach as anybody over the last 4 or 5 years since he's been at Belmont, and frankly, even back into the last few seasons at Lipscomb. We've talked a lot over the last year on this podcast, and really all around Belmont Athletics, Kevin, about the move to the Missouri Valley Conference and the growth of the school, the addition of the Crockett Center, which is such an advantage for this basketball program now, moving into a higher profile league, but also a tougher league as well. As you view it from the outside, no longer intimately connected, what do you think the reasonable expectations are for Belmont basketball now in this new era of Division I basketball?
I think the expectations are probably are or should be what they have always been. That's to be a championship program. And, you know, those things you mentioned, the Crockett Center is, I mean, that's something that like any basketball program in the country would be proud to have. I think Belmont will continue to compete at the highest level in the Missouri Valley or wherever. A lot of success in the OVC in about a decade in that conference and the Atlantic Sun before that. So yeah, it's been the progression of conferences for Belmont over the years. I think there are some around that school and program that always kind of had their eye on the Missouri Valley, feeling like that'd be a good fit for Belmont, especially with the strength in basketball that program has had for so many years. So yeah, I think it was the right move. And I think Belmont will continue to be successful, and it's going to be really challenging because they're, you know, and watching just the games last season, I mean, they're no easy games, you know, whoever you're playing or going on the road or whatever. I mean, all the games are really challenging and difficult, but I think Belmont will be just fine and continue to play at a really high level.
Well, certainly last year we got a great taste of it, and I think the team performed really well and acquitted itself nicely in its first season in the Valley. And that goes for several of the sports, not just men's or women's basketball at Belmont. And Scott Corley has said repeatedly that the goal remains the same. Mm-hmm. It's to win championships, even in a new conference, just like they did when they moved from the A-Sun to the OVC, or frankly, even into Division I way back 20 or so years ago when you were starting out with the program. Let's see, when you look at it, it's basically about one championship per season, I'd say, over the last 20 years.
Right.
Whether you're talking regular season or the tournament titles. Obviously, you were at the mic for so many of those, Kevin. You mentioned 2020 a moment ago about winning it in Casey's first season, but not getting the chance to go to the NCAA tournament. That was heartbreaking, I know, for everybody involved in the program. And diametrically opposed to what happened the year before, in 2019, Coach Bird's final season, he wins his 800th game. He gets to the OVC championship game, losing a heartbreaker in that incredible game that had probably more talent than any OVC game ever on the floor, but then gets an at-large berth to the NCAA tournament and wins the program's first ever game in the Big Dance. What were those few weeks and moments like to be a part of history on the mic with someone you loved and admired so much, like Coach Bird, and to just be there during that time?
Yeah, that was really a special season. And it was a, you know, it's funny, there were some unknowns for that team going into the year. It was a pretty young team. You know, guys like Grayson and Moose and, you know, some others were still pretty young in their career, but you also had some veterans like Dylan Windler and Kevin McLean, and, you know, some guys had been around and played a lot of basketball. But I think you go back earlier that season, went out to UCLA and won on a sweet play that, that Coach Bird drew up and pulled off a scramble play with Grayson Murphy. Yeah, the panic play with Grayson making the pass to Kevin McLean for the layup. I love the photo of that, of Kevin scoring, and you can see me and Sage in the background trying to look around Coach Bird to see the play. But yeah, it turned out to be just a magical season. You mentioned the 800th win, that was against Eastern Illinois. But then to make it to the championship game against Murray State, and, you know, they had John Morant, and it was really cranked up in there. And we had a significant injury that I think maybe hurt our chances a little bit. Not to make any excuses or take anything away from anyone. But I think to get that at-large bid probably said more about where Belmont's program was and the progress that had been made and the amount of respect for the program than maybe anything that had happened to that point. It was really neat. They had a selection show party, and I think you were there inside the Vince Gill room. And we all kind of gathered in there and thinking, you know, how is this going to go? Or, you know, are we going to get in, or are we just going to kind of sit here and hang out for a little bit and then go to the NIT later on, or how is this going to happen? And one of the first brackets that opened up was Belmont playing Temple in the first four in Dayton. And it just set off euphoria. That was one of the most fun moments in all the years I was around there. And from there, it was just a whirlwind. I mean, we were on the plane at 10 o'clock the next morning heading to Dayton. And by Monday night, we were having an open shoot around at the UD arena. And you know, by the next day, we're playing Temple in that late game in the first four. And gosh, it was so special to be there and see that win. And, you know, and kind of see the scene for the players in the locker room when they took that little placard and put it in that bracket and, you know, advanced for the first time. And that was Coach Bird's, you know, first NCAA tournament win. And one of the neat things that was sort of behind the scenes that happened, because when the game was over, like, look, if you win, we're going to get on a plane and we're going to Jacksonville. We're going to play Maryland on Thursday. And so when we went to the airport, we were waiting to go through the security screening, and they had a giant NCAA tournament bracket on the wall there. And whoever had won the first game, I can't remember what team it was, but whoever won the first game, they had taken a Sharpie and written in their team as the winner, you know, in the next line on the bracket. And when we got there, nobody had shown Belmont advancing yet on that bracket. So I took a Sharpie out of my backpack and I made the note there on that big bracket. And Seth Adelsberger gave me a high five. And I thought that was one of the coolest feelings and moments during my time there. And, you know, from there, we flew to Jacksonville. We got there about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they said, okay, everybody, we're going to go take a nap until about noon, and then we'll reconvene and go do what we need to do. And so, you know, we went to the shoot around, which to me is always one of the most fun parts. And, you know, you're hanging out, next thing you know, you're hanging out with Ian Eagle and the crew. And then we played the game the next day. And before all that happened, of course, triple spillage happened in the LSU Yale game, which I think I became more known for than anything in 30 years in radio. But a great game against Maryland came up just short, but it was really special to be a part of. And that was, I always tell people, that was one of the most fun weeks I had in my whole career. It was so much fun from the time we saw our name in the bracket to all the way through to the games in Jacksonville. It was really cool.
Yeah, for those who don't know, run through real quickly what happened in the game before the Belmont Maryland game.
Yeah, so Sage and I are set up. Greg Sage, Belmont's wonderful media relations director. We and he did color on the games with me and does with you for lots of years. So, you know, we got all our gear set up there, and LSU is playing Yale in the first game. And toward the end of the game, there's a loose ball that comes our way, and Emmett Williams, probably about 6'8" forward for LSU, comes chasing the loose ball, trying to save it in. And he ran over us. He just absolutely flattened everything, including me. And I'd gone to the back to get something to drink. So I came back with this full, about 20-ounce cup of Diet Coke, and they didn't have any lids or anything like that. You know, of course, at the NCAA tournament, it's all about, you know, our corporate partners. So right. You have to do it in the official branded cup. So I'm holding this cup of drink, and I was literally trying to find a place to set it down where it wouldn't get spilled. And about that time, I've had to go back and like watch this to just sort of recreate in my brain what happened, because it was almost like I blacked out for a minute. So the ball gets there. The ball got there first, and I put my hand up to catch the ball. And then I was looking at the ball. Don't get caught ball watching. But and Emmett Williams just comes over the table and just flattens me at that point. And, you know, and of course, it just goes viral. And I didn't really even, once we got all our stuff cleaned up and I figured out that I was okay. I had a little cut on my arm, but, you know, I was okay. And a radio gear worked, you know, I was soaked with drink, and so was Emmett. But everybody was good. I never really thought about it being that big of a deal, but of course on that stage, everybody's watching these games and, you know, it's all over social media and everywhere. And I got people texting me and texting my wife, who's a, you know, she's working at a school, and a couple, you know, not long after that, she texted me. She's like, what is going on? You know, she had no idea what had happened. You know, she didn't see any of this. And so, it kind of took on a life of its own, but it was really fun. And the triple spillage came from Ian Eagle and Jim Sponarkle. They were doing the game on TV, and they showed the replay a whole bunch of times, and it was the, you know, Coke Zero Orange play of the game for like the next two or three games. But it was fun. You know, I guess you got to be noted for something. And the thing I figured out pretty quickly is that I got to have some fun with this. And I tried to. I hope that that showed. And I got a picture with Emmett Williams when he came off the court. And to me, that was like the most fun part of the whole thing, was the LSU people helped me track down Emmett Williams. We got a photo after the game, and he's like, yeah, I hope to see you Saturday. We'll get a soda.
Well, that's amazing. And such a fun week for anybody who cares about Belmont athletics, and the stories from that week are legendary. And to see Coach Bird get that win was awesome. And frankly, for the program, maybe even more than the win itself, getting in as one of the two non-Power 5 at-large teams in the last, 15 years or so is really, really a special moment for the program. I'm curious, obviously NCAA tournament games are awesome, but can you give me a quick list of your favorite places to call games?
Gosh, we went everywhere. And I actually thought about this not long ago when I did Vanderbilt's win at Kentucky back in early March. There are three arenas, I believe, that have six men's national championship banners. UCLA has 11, Kentucky has 8, and I think North Carolina has 6. And I've been fortunate enough to call road wins in all three of those places. And I don't know that very many people can say that. And I actually got to thinking too, James Strong, who is on Vanderbilt staff now, was on Belmont staff for those wins at UCLA and North Carolina. So those are really special. They come to mind. The win at UCLA we talked about earlier, and to win at North Carolina was really cool. We played, you know, we kind of played at a lot of the big places. We played at Rupp one time with Belmont, and the Craig Bradshaw dunk in that game was one I remember for a long time. We played at Duke and played them close. The game in the NCAA tournament in 2008 was just legendary. I can't speak for everybody, but it took me a long time to get over that one. When you play that close and have a chance to be a 15-2 upset, which in a lot of ways, to me, maybe not as big of an upset as some people might have thought, because that was a really good Belmont team back in 08. But then we also played at Cameron, and Ian Clark hit a three at the buzzer, and we only lost by 1 point in that game, and had a chance to win there too. Went a lot of cool places. I thought Kansas was really special. They had some great teams. I'm good friends with Keaton Belcher, who was on one or both of those Belmont teams, went to Kansas and played. And he's like, yeah, I was having fun until I looked around and I was guarding the Morris twins. And Kansas had some fantastic teams. That to me is about as great as an atmosphere as you're going to find in college basketball. But we went a lot of cool places. We went to Alaska 1 year. We played the Great Alaska Shootout in 2012. Went to Pepperdine one time, which was just beautiful. But yeah, lots and lots of great places. We went to your alma mater. We went to Illinois one time, and it was really cranked up for a Sunday afternoon game, and a non-conference game. You don't always know what you're going to get, but that was cool. We went to Michigan State. We played at Ohio State. We just went a little bit of everywhere over the years, and it was all a lot of fun. The NIT game at Clemson, that's another one in 2014. That one was really special too.
I'm trying to elbow both Casey and Brad into getting that game back on the schedule at some point for me.
Yeah.
But there are just so many places you get to go out there that are really cool when you do a job like this, and you feel blessed to have the opportunity to walk into those places, let alone be a part of the action from behind the mic, and that includes the place you're at now, Vanderbilt. Very unique perspective with the benches on the end and the broadcast booths literally below the floor as you try to look out there and try to call the game. But I got to ask, has maybe the weirdest experience in your broadcasting career, would it have been the 2022 NIT game when it was Belmont at Vanderbilt and you're calling this school that you have such a deep history with and such a great respect and love for with your current job and the current school that you love and have such a deep respect for?
Yeah, those things do get a little weird sometimes. To me, it's more before and after the game that you feel it. During the game, like once the ball goes up, you're calling a game and you're rooting for your team. And, you know, my rule number one, I always think of broadcasting, is you always pull for your employer. But it was, yeah, it's neat to see those two on the court. I don't know that I want to see it all the time, but yeah, that game was interesting. Of course, I was happy that Vanderbilt won and we were able to advance and go on and play a couple more games. But you know, before and after the games, you and I even, I think we did a pregame interview, but before that one, and you know, to visit with the Belmont folks and see everybody, but also see our team with Vanderbilt, and Coach Dackhouse has done a terrific job and feels like really, really building a good program here too. So yeah, those things are neat. It was always kind of weird too when Belmont played Western Kentucky. That's my alma mater. And again, like once the game starts, you know, like to me, all that kind of goes away and you're just doing it. But that one was always a little different for me too, especially when we played up in Bowling Green. And I think I was undefeated against my alma mater. So I don't remember Western ever winning in that series. So yeah, you get into some of those interesting situations and people ask me about that stuff sometimes, but man, you're always your mind and heart are with the team that you're calling the game. And that's the way I always approach it.
I don't know if Sage will agree with me on this, but I feel like as the play-by-play guy, you're obviously invested, but you kind of have to suspend your emotion a little bit because you're just so into every minute detail of what's going on. You're obviously into the game and you're energetic about it, but you can't live and die with every free throw or every play because I don't think you'd do a very good job at it.
Yeah, you do. And I hope, that's well put, because I've thought about these things a lot too, is like, you have to keep going and you can't get too, you know, emotionally wrapped up in, you know, one particular play or call or whatever's going on. I mean, you know, you certainly feel it and you get mad sometimes and you feel like a call doesn't go your way or something happens in the game, but you know, you have, I guess I always try to default back to being professional and being respectful of not just our team, but the other team and the other coaches and things. And I don't know. I don't know that people want to listen to a broadcast where people are like way over top as homers. Like they want to hear what's really going on. And you know, you're always going to reflect that you're pulling for the team that you're working for. But I think there's also sort of that balance of being a pro and being fair toward the opponents and those things too, because the other teams make good plays sometimes, and that's just the way it is. And you know, things don't always go your way, but yeah, I don't think there's ever any big secret, you know, that I'm pulling for Vanderbilt when I'm doing Vanderbilt games. If you listen to Tim and I call the games or baseball or whatever it might be.
Kevin, I got one last big topic of college athletics before I get to the final three questions I do with everybody. And that's just the state of the sport in general, the state of college athletics in general with the transfer portal. Obviously, NIL has become a huge part of the game in the last few years, especially at the college basketball level. It's an arms race in terms of what programs are doing. We talked about Vandy United. We've seen what Belmont's done with the Crockett Center. As you view it all, your thoughts on just kind of the state of the game itself and maybe how Vanderbilt and Belmont fit in now in this new era in your mind?
Yeah, I think for both these schools, it's a really challenging time, you know, with the, you know, NIL and the transfer portal. Those things are such big topics all the time. And you feel for coaches basically having to re-recruit their players. It feels like after every season. I was reading an anonymous coach survey that CBS Sports did, and it was talking to coaches about, you know, the stress level of going through all that and burnout for coaches and those things. And I wonder if guys like Roy Williams or Coach K or you know, some of the others that Jay Wright and, you know, some others that big names that you've seen leave the game, would they have stayed around a little bit longer if some of these things hadn't been such factors? I don't know that they would, but it could have made a difference. I just think all the way around, it's a really challenging time for everybody involved in athletics to, you know, figure out financially how to make it all work. And it's an arms race and facilities and those things, you know, especially in the big money sports. I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the things that have gone on with realignment. I think it's sad to see a lot of the regional rivalries and matchups that you've seen that have become so ingrained for a lot of people go away. Like what happened in the Pac-12 to me is just, it's hard to understand and believe. And it all comes, I know a lot of it comes down to money, and money talks, as the saying goes. But and to me, like Oregon and Wisconsin making that move to the Big Ten is really strange. And I sort of like the Pac-12 after dark, man. I want to see Bill Walton and Dave Pash in the Conference of Champions. I mean, I want to see those games. But it's going to have a whole different look and feel coming up in, you know, in the near future here. And of course, the SEC is adding Oklahoma and Texas in next year. And that'll be different too. And we'll give a very different look to the league and how the scheduling goes and those things. So I think for everybody involved in college athletics, it's an interesting and challenging time to figure out how it's going to fit together and work. And, you know, 10 years down the road, what's it all going to look like? What's the NCAA tournament going to look like, or the college football playoff? How different will those things be when we get to say 2033 instead of 23?
Yeah, that's one thing to talk about what it looks like in football, but I don't know who is clamoring for the Washington Rutgers soccer game.
Oh, man. Oh, gosh. Those are the teams you really feel for. I mean, you think about like soccer and tennis and, you know, track and field and volleyball and those other sports where, you know, they're probably, all those teams aren't jumping on charter planes and going to all their games. You know, you think about a middle of the week match where you're going cross country to play. I don't know that that's good for anybody's health, but it is what it is. And that's what we're going to see here in these next few years. And it'll be interesting too, to see if they, you know, they come out like say the Big Ten, where it's going to be spread all over the place, or even the ACC, if these teams out West end up there, what the schedule is going to be like. Are they going to break it up into divisions where it makes it a little more user-friendly? You're still talking about some really long road trips. Even if you split up the Big Ten into East and West, I mean, you think about like Nebraska and Iowa and those teams, they're still going to have to go out West and play. So yeah, it's going to be really something to see.
Well, Kevin, and you bring up some of those other sports. I think that's the question moving forward, is there have been 94 Division I sports dropped since COVID. And a lot of that was COVID related, but now you move into this new era, and depending how the courts break out, you could see this thing where football breaks off and those players may even become employees of the university. And who knows what happens then in terms of the future of some of those Olympic sports, which I think would be really, really sad for people who love amateur athletics and what college athletics and the student athlete experience is supposed to be. One thing I can promise people at home, though, that as challenging as it is, both the administration at Vanderbilt, where you are now, and at Belmont, led by Scott Corley and Renee Schultz, they are working tirelessly to make sure that they will take advantage of every opportunity that they can to make sure that the student athlete experience is still the same at those universities and that the best opportunities are afforded to the people who go there.
Yeah, I think those are things that both these universities have going for them. Here at Vanderbilt with Candace Lee, our athletic director, and she's going to have some deputy athletic director spots to fill here just in the near future. And at Belmont, where Scott Corley's done such a terrific job there too. I think having those terrific leaders, and you mentioned Renee also, having those leaders makes all the difference. And you have a lot of confidence. I think if you're at either place, you have a lot of confidence in the leadership that they're going to make the right decisions. And they're going to work hard to make sure everything for the programs, for the student athletes, is as good as it possibly can be. And I think that's one thing you can, among a lot of things, but certainly you can feel good about the leadership at these two universities.
All right, Kevin, let's get to the big three, the final three questions that everybody who comes on the podcast gets asked, because they aren't necessarily specific to you, but they're sort of wide-ranging blue sky questions that I feel like give the listeners a better perspective of who you are and what makes you tick in that regard. So we've talked a lot about your profession and your journey behind the microphone or in front of the camera as a broadcaster. But if you weren't doing this, if you didn't ever have that chance to start as a sports reporter and then a sports broadcaster, what would you be doing?
That's a great question. I don't know that I'd even be in Nashville if broadcasting hadn't happened. I to go back to when I was a teenager, my uncle had worked in radio some, and he got me interested in this. So I always joke that I don't really have any other marketable skills. I've worked in radio for over 30 years. People have asked me this before, and this answer might surprise some people, but anybody who knows me very well knows that I'm a huge rock and roll fan, especially of bands like from the 70s and 80s. So if I could have done something different, I wish I could have been in like a big rock band. Like I could have been like a lead singer or guitar player. I wanted to be like Eddie Van Halen, you know, when I was a kid. I don't know how to play any instruments. I'll be honest with you on that. But I think that would have been the thing for me. Like, I think it would have been fun to be in some big band. It's funny. There's a guy at our church. He plays in the church band, and he plays keyboards, and he plays guitar and other things. But and his day job is he plays in Hootie and the Blowfish, and he posts all these pictures of them on tour, and like his perspective from sitting in front of the keyboards at the back of the stage, and these great crowd scenes and all that stuff. And I've thought for years, like, how cool would that be to have that feeling, you know? And I was talking about, you know, what it would be like to stand in front of this 10-foot wall of guitar amps, you know, and play like, you know, Eddie Van Halen or whoever. I think that would have been my thing. I think I would have liked to have been in a rock band.
Kevin, I don't know how you'd look with a little bit longer hair, kind of rock star stuff.
See, I don't know.
That's the most creative answer I think we've had.
My hair doesn't grow like that either. I don't know how. I might have had to get some extensions or something like that.
Well, that's kind of a funny picture. Second question is, what inspires you? What's the thing that when you wake up in the morning and you get set to go do another day's work or get set to go do another game, what inspires you to do it the best you can?
A lot of it is my family, my wife, Amy, my son, Reed. They're a lot of my reason for being and for getting up in the morning. Part of get up in the morning, I get Reed to school, which is a challenge sometimes too. But yeah, they're just such a big part of my life. And, you know, I try to have that balance with work and with the family and at home. And, you know, people talk about being present when they're home. I really try to make an effort to do that. But, you know, as far as the professional part of it goes, I love doing broadcast work. I love being on the radio. I love being on, you know, doing games on TV. I love all of it, especially calling games. I love doing play-by-play. It's what I wanted to do since I was a little kid. I was not a good athlete. And my friends had told me, he's like, we always knew if you worked in sports, it wouldn't be as playing because you weren't very good at much of anything. I was like, thanks a lot. But I always wanted to call games from the time I was a child. And so to have that opportunity, especially to do it at these places and at this level, man, I feel really, really blessed.
There's nothing like being courtside or in a press box or whatever and being part of the action. No matter what story you're covering or what events you're covering, there's nothing like actually being a part of it. And I agree. It's really, really cool to have the opportunity to do that. So the final question is, and you can kind of take this wherever you go, how do you get away at the end of it all? Maybe it's at the end of a season. Maybe it's after one of the teams you cover wins the championship game or something awesome happens in the family or whatever. How do you celebrate? How do you get away? How do you enjoy the downtime in life in those few precious moments that you have?
It's funny. Whenever teams like say for Belmont won championships or huge wins at Vanderbilt here, or like even like we went to the College World Series and working with Tim Corbin, this baseball program here has been unbelievable too. I always felt like I wanted to leave the celebrating to others. As much as I might've enjoyed that moment, it was more fun for me to kind of sit back and watch everybody else have that moment. And just watch it all go down and watch people climb up the ladder and cut down nets and you know, watch people on the field. Like I was looking out here thinking about it. I sat in this booth and Vanderbilt, you know, clinch a spot in the College World Series, to watch those guys get out there and celebrate and enjoy that moment and go around and high five with the fans, or, you know, like last year won a lot of big games over here next door at Memorial Gym. I always feel like I just kind of want to be an observer. I don't want to be in the middle of, you know, you tell everyone congratulations and handshakes and hugs and all that stuff. But I kind of wanted to just sit back and let everybody else enjoy that moment, especially the student athletes, because those moments are so kind of fleeting for them. And you have such a short time and a short career, you know, in whatever sport you're playing. As far as like unwinding and that, a lot of it for me is, you know, when the game's over for me, I just, you know, I'm not going out and hanging out somewhere when it's over. I'm just going back home, you know, to my family. And, you know, I think about this a lot. It's like, I do all these really fun things, go all these big places, but at heart, I'm really just kind of this average guy. I mean, I mow the yard and you know, cook on the grill and hang out at home and go out to eat with my wife and son. You know, we usually do a beach trip every year. And for me, there's something kind of interesting about that. Like I always feel like I kind of either stand on the beach or like go out on the water or something. And I look up and it's sort of give thanks for making it through another year and just the life that I have. And yeah, no one's more appreciative of the opportunities that I've been given than me. And yeah, I think the beach trip is always a little bit of the kind of the one that sort of feels like a release and a reset and get ready for the next one.
I tell you what, I really appreciate that answer, Kevin, because I just got back from Door County, Wisconsin, where my family has gone since I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
And it has really become that moment for me every year where I'm up there for a week or a little bit more if I'm lucky, and it's right before the start of football season and everything gets crazy for another 9 or 10 months. And I'll often sit there, beautiful sunsets because it's looking west over Green Bay. And I often will sit there during that moment. And it's so out of the ordinary of what my life is in downtown Nashville and what I cover on a daily basis. But it's in those moments where I often sit there and just thank God for the blessings of the last year to get to this moment and then what's to come. And it's like in that moment, I get refreshed to come back and do it all over again.
Yeah. And I find myself, you know, even in the middle of the season, I think about it and start looking forward to that. You know, I'll be sitting there in January to be freezing or be snow on the ground or something. It's like, you know, it's only a few short months until we'll be sitting on the beach again. And even when I'm like riding around the yard on the riding lawnmower, I think about this is such, you know, the things that the place I've been and things that I've done are so different from just, you know, living and, you know, just being out here mowing grass. But yeah, I always try to make sure. And you feel that more as you get a little bit older and you're a little deeper in your career and know you're kind of closer to the end than the beginning, but you make sure you sort of give thanks in appropriate ways and to the right people too, that you're able to have these chances.
Just a normal guy mowing the yard, and you say you try to stay out of the action, but whether it's Emmett Thomas jumping over the table or calling championships, Kevin, you've been right in the middle of it for more than two decades now in a lot of people in Nashville's minds and some really great moments. So congratulations on that. Everybody at Belmont is thrilled for your success down the road at Vanderbilt. We miss you, but we also love watching and listening to you still. And we wish you the best of luck this season. And thanks so much for the time today coming on the podcast.
Absolutely, Steve. And you do a great job too. I've enjoyed hearing you and Greg call the games. And both these universities are so special and so neat to be a part of. And the city of Nashville, I've lived here for 25 years. And it's been really cool to see how this place has grown as a sports town, as a college sports town, as a professional sports town. So yeah, it's a great place to be. And looking forward to hopefully many more years.